Welcome back to the Ignite podcast. Today, I'm delighted to have Jack Song and Andrew Pushell on the program. It's our first time having two guests at once, so you get a two for one today. I'm pretty excited about that. Jack and Andrew, would love to get an intro from you both for the audience.
Sure. Jack, why don't you go first and then I'll follow up.
Excellent. Hello, I'm Jack. My background, gosh, I spent probably the past two decades focusing on brand strategy and communications. I started my career in entertainment, working on big blockbuster films, moved over to politics, political campaigns, and for the last decade, after going to business school with Brian, really doubled down on tech. I just have a passion for launching new companies. I love it when I think Mrs. O'Shea down the street has no idea, you know, what's a crypto, what's a scooter, what's computer vision. So that really excites me of introducing new technology to the world. Andrew?
Thanks, Jack.
That's fantastic. I'll give a quick kind of history about me. So in college, I was trying to figure out what to do with my life and career. And I looked back on childhood and I kind of realized that I loved building things. I liked technology and design. I grew up in a designy family. So my whole career has kind of existed at the intersection of those three things. I started my career as a brand manager at L'Oreal and then ultimately did a turnaround of a company called F. Schumacher & Company, or participated in that turnaround, where I sit on the board now. And then I went to Harvard for business school, and the call of kind of California was really strong. So I moved out to San Francisco and joined Apple, focused on retail strategy and experience design. And then from there, I had several startup experiences, including one at Hashdex, where I met Jack. And I actually used the 2 years of the pandemic to move to Rio de Janeiro and really have a great experience down there.
Nice.
And then as Jack and I were talking and I was thinking about moving back to the US, one idea we had was in a role that I have as a venture partner at a seed stage VC firm called Matterscale, just observing kind of how I was helping our portfolio companies with marketing. And, you know, oftentimes they would kind of need the elements of a full marketing team, but not 100% of a comms person or 100% of, you know, an editorial lead. And so the idea was a fractional marketing team to kind of help our seed stage companies get to Series B. Because what was happening is they would inevitably, or all seed stage companies tend to hire one or two generalists. And then, you know, there's a lot of foundation building and going back on brand strategy and different work when you get more capital later on. So the idea was to help them kind of move forward ahead of their competitors. And our firm, Colony 5, has evolved a little bit. We now also work with, you know, large public companies as well as startups. But, you know, our heart is really in the startups, or even startups within established enterprises, because you just get so much more impact. And we love working with founders.
Yeah, that's amazing. So when is too early to engage a firm like Colony 5? What's the kind of stage that you guys tend to specialize in? And where do startups usually, at what stage of the life cycle do they need services like what you guys provide?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's never too early. I mean, we definitely have a lot of conversations where we'll chat with someone and we'll say, you know, you and your team or your business is not quite ready. You know, it's better to spend this time trying to really like put your effort into finding more clarity or line of sight onto product market fit. Mm-hmm. But in those roles, we kind of help in an advisory capacity. And so the ideal happy path is, you know, when you're starting out, you really figure out kind of what your strategy and market is, but that can be loose until you get product market fit. And then you really hone that in. And then so that brand foundation and that brand strategy, which includes messaging and positioning and, you know, a visual identity, which is really a manifestation of brand strategy, all of that becomes the platform on which content is created to build a community. PR and communications are used to really get the word out about the brand, add credibility, engage a community, and as well as employees, and go from there.
And so you could almost argue like it's at the inception, right? It's,
yeah.
Hey, I have a startup idea, and I'm starting to build something, and now I need to go sell it, and now I need to think about my brand strategy and my go to market and how I message this thing. And
yeah, there's a lot of misconception about what brands are. I think You know,
yeah. So what is a brand? Let's start there. I see that in our show notes here. What is a brand?
You know, it's really a brand is a trust vehicle between a company and its consumers or audience. And actually the kind of, if you think about it, the understanding of brands has evolved over, say, the past 50 years. So the traditional view was very much an informational role where, you know, brands were these intangible assets and they provided value to a firm and its customers. You know, it was a name, design, that kind of thing. And a more contemporary view is a brand plays kind of a multidimensional role and they infuse choice situations with meaning. You know, you might be choosing between two, all other things being equal, the same products, and one has a brand that kind of articulates values that resonate with you. And that brings meaning to that choice situation beyond just kind of features and price and things like that. And so they're kind of like brands are ultimately over time become tinted glasses through which consumers and an audience sees a company's products and services and activities. And really, if you can think of them as a web of associations, both tangible and intangible. And so you can actually, if you think about the history of brands, like a great example is in Pompeii. Pompeii, the city that was destroyed by a volcano, was also known as a hub for baking and food, a culinary hotspot. And there were so many bakers that to differentiate and kind of identify people's different products, they started putting stamps, and you can still find cakes, or not find, they're in museums, cakes that have stamps on them identifying kind of which bakery they came from. Those are examples of kind of very early, you know, elements of branding. So brand management ultimately becomes meaning management, I think.
Well, and another thing to think about, I think, as well with the evolution of startups, is especially with the advent of very strong AI that we're experiencing, as technological moats are going away and maybe all you have left are brand moats and kind of just execution moats. So how do startups think, how should they think about brand? Let's start with like kind of your standard pre-series A, kind of a pre-seed seed startup. Maybe I just raised the friends and family round. Maybe I got accepted into YC or Techstars. Yeah. What should I know about brand versus, okay, now I'm like series A or B.
Okay. Great question. So your brand is who you are. If you're a person, your personality and your identity would be that. That would be the analog to a company's brand. So it's not kind of the draperies or the paint that you put on at the end of building a house and designing it. It very much is part of your business strategy. So the components are, you know, values and a personality, visual identity, you know, positioning and messaging, identifying what your customer promise really is. What is your value proposition and why should someone care? And then, of course, voice and messaging and how that manifests itself into the product and service choices that you make.
So do you think brand in this case is an intentional decision by startups, or does it kind of happen, like, is it an emergent property in the process of building and selling something?
It's a little bit of both. I mean, there are two schools of thought on this, and I think the truth is somewhere in the middle. There are, you can identify, you know, a niche market and then figure out a product and service to meet that need and then develop a brand that will resonate, or you hope it will resonate. But then the long-term brands that we all know, whether or not it's a Nintendo or an Apple, they tend to stand for something that goes beyond products and services. You know, like the vision or stated vision or purpose of Nintendo is evergreen. It's to put smiles on people's faces. That was relevant when they were making playing cards 100 years ago, and it's relevant today. But I think one of the big things for a founder at any stage, especially very early on, is to think about a brand as kind of an identity. So we all went to high school and we knew someone who dressed a certain way with one group of friends and a different way with another group of friends. It's kind of hard to trust a person like that. And it's the same thing.
I didn't know anybody like that, Andrew. Who are your friends?
So consistency is super important because people want to understand that
You actually knew somebody like that in high school that was like literally would just change their clothes? Like, I'm a skater now. And
for sure. And I think, there's no judgment. It's kind of people exploring their own identity and figuring out who they are as well. So thinking about it as an identity, like, who are you? And there will be iterations of that, but writing down kind of, why do we exist? So, our mission is, what are we doing today? But what's our purpose that, even if we solve this problem over the next decade, what would we still get excited about doing?
Yeah.
And, that stuff evolves and there's emergent components. But I think being intentional about that early on makes a lot of difference.
I think brand strategy, when folks hear that, I think there's a misconception that it's just about color palettes and a website. It's beyond that. It's really a business alignment tool. And I've seen this firsthand at this was a Series A startup. And we went through this brand strategy exercise, messaging and positioning. So what is the company, who we are, why we matter, et cetera. And through this exercise, it was fascinating to see that the C-suites have no idea what they're really building, what the focus is, what the product, eventual product is, and who's their target audience. So it's a great business alignment tool as well.
Love that. What if startups get wrong about their brand and they have to recover or repair later?
The biggest thing is misalignment. So, or just kind of not being intentional about like the extra amount of investment and thinking that would create a stronger foundation. Like a little course correction early on goes a long way because it compounds. Mm-hmm. And so I think that is the biggest one.
Yeah, I often think about this for Team Ignite. Like I chose the color orange because that's flames, but orange is also like kind of like hungry and it's on fire and like, but I'm investing capital, so I'm not lighting capital on fire. So I often think about that as a Team Ignite brand. Maybe I should have went with like a blue flame.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's working out so far. But
a good example of kind of how something might be wrong is, we work with executive teams pretty frequently. And it's very common for me to hand everyone on the leadership team a piece of paper and say, write down the company's mission. And they're all different. Yeah. Sometimes they're reflecting the personal mission of that individual and why they're there. Sometimes it's a guess as to the company's mission. And the net of that is, if you don't know what you're trying to do or who you're serving, oftentimes we'll ask, who's your customer and get different answers among, this is the leadership team, so they should be really in sync. Then that impacts resource allocation decisions. It impacts product choices. So, one product might be appropriate for, X customer group, and another one might be completely appropriate for Y customer group, but they could be very different. And, startups where both time and resources are in such short supply, really being clear about your brand strategy, which is, part and parcel to your business strategy, really helps, just get the highest ROI out of your time and effort as well.
Love it. So what's your typical, if I can ask, if you don't mind sharing, what is the typical brand strategy implementation project look like? How long does it take? How much does it cost for an early stage startup? So anyone that's listening can go, okay, yeah, I can fit that in. I just raised a couple million,
Yeah, no, for sure. So, for large companies, everything is, like all of our services are custom
customized and
but what we've learned is that there's a lot of value for us and our startup clients in kind of more standardizing a process because we can just be more efficient and then build on that. But typically, it all starts with kind of brand strategy, which is the inputs in the way we do it includes kind of like classic business strategy, as well as your classic kind of brand strategy process, which is, looking at competitors, how they're positioning themselves, how they talk about themselves, visuals, and really trying to find white space in the market. And then really, like our thing is starting with the people, the customers, the audience, the stakeholders, and working our way backwards. Because that emotional connection that a brand can be the bridge for has like tremendous payoffs because you really want to create a resonant brand that, you know, it's not just products and features and you know, prices that people are choosing. You know, think about like, the way people choose Patagonia as versus, you know, just like a random outdoor wear brand.
Yeah.
And so the typical process really starts with kind of a brand strategy component. And, you know, if it's a 5-person startup, we can hammer that out in a couple, you know, 3-hour workshops. One thing about Colony 5 is just from before our first client, we just set out and we said, we'll never try and upsell someone. We'll never try and sell them something that they don't need. Jack and I and everyone else on our team, this is our first time in an agency role, but we've hired agencies, but we've been in operating roles our whole careers.
Right.
From scrappy startups all the way to, you know, larger companies like Apple.
Big unicorns, right? Like yep. Jack was at a couple of different unicorns, I remember. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, so typically there's that brand strategy and the outputs of that are kind of these really, these core experience pillars, as well as some, you know, like messaging and positioning, which has...
We're talking, to answer the question, we're kind of talking in the order of like thousands of dollars, not tens of thousands of dollars. Or somewhere in that range for like an early stage startup to kind of work with you guys as at the very inception of what they're doing.
Yeah, at the very inception, like depending on kind of the scale of what they want to do, and also depends on the nature of their product and where they are, could be between 10 and 25,000. Cool. Goes up from there.
Yep.
So let's switch gears a little bit before we, because I do want to move on to PR and get Jack's kind of input on that. But I thought we would kind of steer it towards now venture capital firms, right? Because a big part of our audience are VCs. So tell us a little bit about brand strategy for venture firms and how it impacts, you know, fundraising and attracting deal flow. And what are some things that VC firms get right and wrong in this area?
Yeah. I mean,
asking for a friend.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The principles are the same. You know, it's really, I think we really believe in mission-driven brands. Mission-driven companies tend to outperform on some key metrics, and you know, even down to engaged employees. And I think that the VC firms that articulate why they're focusing on a sector or a niche, or why their investment thesis is important, and root that in thinking and values that go beyond, we think this is just going to make the, you know, the highest returns, really, really makes a lot of sense. And alongside that, you're seeing just a whole regime shift from last decade when startups had big raises and they could dump money into pay-per-click ads. Didn't matter if the customers were profitable or anything like that. It was just grow, grow, grow. And now there's real thinking, like, does that customer make sense to acquire if they're going to churn out or they're not going to be ultimately the right customer? And I think the VC firms that are taking their knowledge and turning themselves inside out by really opening up more and more content and publishing content and creating a community around that, I think are really doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm. Ignite podcast. So let's switch to PR. Jack, like, what are some things that startups should know, especially at the earliest stages, and then we can take kind of later stage after, about PR?
Yeah, I think for startups, knowing your DNA, what you stand for, what product you're developing, who's your target audience, I think that's really the foundational aspect. And that's why we always try to start with the messaging and positioning for the company, not so much on the product, but for the company. And that's where Andrew really comes in and helped to develop the kind of the rational side, how we talk about the company, and the emotional side. And that's the brand. It could be the visual, it could be the kind of the overall brand experience. When is a good time for a startup to bring in PR support? My recommendation is when there are clear milestones in either product development or hiring execs, where you're creating this momentum and you're creating this FOMO in the space where you're attracting attention from investors. So once you feel like there is that key milestones happening, I think that's when it's important to bring like a PR support in to help amplify the message.
So you landed like a big round, a big $3, $5, $10 million round, or you hired some key exec or any of the above. And what do you see the mistakes that startups are making that try to kind of go it alone, right? Try to go, I'm not going to pay, you know, $5, $10, whatever it is for a PR firm. I'll just issue my own press release and write a blog post. And like, what do they get wrong?
Yeah.
What are they missing? Yeah.
I think that's fine. It's, I learned this very early on from my PR mentor is my go-to line is who cares? So why should your news matter to, again, Mrs. O'Shea down the street? Why is it going to change the world? The news hook is very important there. And then we're also seeing in the press that given the changing kind of landscape in the media, it's a crowded market, you know, but the ones that with really good news that's timely are the ones that are able to kind of beat the frothiness and get the attention of the journalists. And another misconception now I want to correct is that, you know, it doesn't matter now if it's a big round of funding. In fact, if it's smaller, like seed stage fund, as long as the product, the value prop is there, the press would be interested. And of course, AI is the current hot topic right now and will continue to be. So anything relating to AI, the press wants to learn more about it.
Right.
One thing to add is, you know, part of, so there's the idea of engaging a PR firm, but the way you get the most mileage is also having someone on your team with the bandwidth to work with that firm. Otherwise, they're being paid and they're kind of sitting out there. So for our startup clients, we created a model where Jack or someone else on our team acts as a fractional head of comms, filling that role, because it's usually at that stage that role doesn't exist. And then we also bring in, you know, one or more people with niche expertise in that area and also those relationships. So it enables us to kind of get more traction and deliver results earlier while also kind of addressing the needs of kind of the operating business and that they need that expertise, but they haven't made that hire yet.
Yeah, it's a little bit of like information brokering, right? There's a little behind the scenes thing that happens between you got your startup, you got your PR firm or brand strategy, whatever you guys want to call yourselves, jack of all trades or whatever. And then you have these media outlets. What's kind of that? Is it a relationship there where you're like, oh, I know who to talk to at TechCrunch to like get this covered? What is some of that secret sauce that's happening on the behind the scenes?
It's pretty old school. I'll let Jack get into the details, but you know, actually, Jack, just take it away. It's an interesting of the industry.
Yeah, I got this pent up anger here. The reason why I say that is I think I've seen this happen quite a few times. Well, first of all, when I was in house, I interviewed over 70 different PR agencies. So I have a very clear kind of understanding of the landscape. And at the height of my, you know, being in-house working at Lime specifically, I have 4 agencies of record and they were fantastic. I think what makes a great PR agency or PR support is folks that have the experience, have relationship with the press, but they're smart. They read every day. It's really unfortunate. I've seen a lot of PR specialists, you know, they worked maybe 1 year at an agency or 1 year at in-house role, and they think they know how to run the game. And it's really, PR is what I call it, is truth better told. So the art of storytelling, the art of bringing in business, kind of meeting business objectives, but also telling that story in an impactful way. It's a skill set. And I think it's important for founders to really make sure that the PR support they're bringing on are able to talk the talk and walk the walk.
Love that. Yeah, you said a couple really good snippets there. The truth better told. I love that.
Yeah, you know, and I would stay away from PR agents, they just call them agencies, PR agency or PR support folks, where they're like, oh, I'm really good in spinning. There's no spinning in PR. It's how do you communicate effectively? If you need to spin, the press can pick up on that. And by the way, crisis communications is also something that we do very well.
Oh, yeah. So now I do need to tell the story better, right? I need to tell this truth in a better way. I like that. I like that spin on the spin there.
And that's where the relationships that you alluded to come in, which is, you know, reporters, they want to get the highest quality information in packaged and interesting stories for their readers. And so those relationships come from working with people who over the course of that relationship have proven that they're reliable sources for that. So they're not pitching kind of vacant, you know, just like empty stories about startups just to get something there. There's real news there.
Yeah. I want to add that both Andrew and I, obviously we have our business school, you know, graduate degree background, but we've also been operators. We've been in the trenches helping companies to build. So we understand the key business milestones that the organization need to hit. And sometimes you can really leverage PR to drive that momentum, try to get more investors or go out and fundraise or acquire customers. And I've observed that sometimes PR agencies, you know, they don't understand that dynamic of leveraging PR to push business. So for example, if you land a New York Times front page article in January, but the press doesn't hear from you for another 6 months, you lose that momentum and credibility.
Yeah. I think what you're touching on, you're steering the conversation this way. So I'll just ask the question, which is, I'm a startup founder and I know I need PR. Like I listened to this podcast and I'm interested so far because I know I need to kind of tell the truth better. How do I assess, you know, like you said, you did 70 interviews, right? And you had four on call or whatever. Like, how do you assess and prioritize if there's 70 different PR or brand strategy agencies to choose from?
Yeah, I think I have a few kind of my go-to checklists. One is energy. Do they bring energy? Do they bring that enthusiasm to you, to the founder? Are they willing to ride or die with you? That's one. Number two is the experience, the years of experience, really like getting down and dirty and building the brand from the ground up. I look for that. And three, I look for diversity. And that's both diversity in background, but also diversity in thought, because different life experiences help you to create even better storytelling and sometimes may alert some blind spots. So for example, I worked on the campaign and I was the only person of color on this campaign. And let's just say the main agencies, they want to do a campaign called A Day Without Scooters, try to pressure the government, trying to get, you know, scooter permits. Well, that sounds kind of insensitive. It's you're comparing scooters to a day without immigrants, which is like May 1st, labor, kind of focusing on labor. So, you know, being the only person of color there, I was able to yank that campaign and change the direction. But if we were had...
Could have backfired.
Yeah. Absolutely. So I look for, you know, folks that are experienced in, that have a lot of experience in different sectors as well. So those are kind of my checklist.
Yeah. Andrew, you got a... Anything to add?
Yeah, I would say, you know, for companies that have been around for a while, you know, the work that they've done is important. But always you have to keep in mind that there were two parties involved. So the client company and the team there also impacted that work. Yeah. But I think, you know, in those conversations, you're really looking for integrity and thinking, you know, someone who's thinking like a partner. Because there are certainly firms whose business model is to acquire, do the work, and churn customers out. And I think you don't get the same long-term thinking in that approach. So there's that. And then relevant experience for your niche. And then, you know, for us, one of our kind of learnings that is a differentiator, and it's just become something that we realized is more valuable to our clients than we initially appreciated, was just our operating experience. Because I think there are a lot of firms working with startups that have never been in that environment before, never worked at a startup. So they'll create, you know, a beautiful brand identity or visual identity with these custom fonts. But the reality is in a distributed startup, everyone's using Google Slides and stuff like that, which doesn't support any of that. And there's just that level of like pragmatism that really either comes from having been in those shoes before or, you know, really like a lot of experience with startups and learning that over time.
Yeah.
Oh, I was going to add, this is actually a great kind of segue of introducing how Andrew and I met. So Andrew and I connected when Andrew was the advisor and also partner at Hashdex, which is a crypto asset management firm. And I think Andrew was looking for someone to help with PR support. And Andrew, why me?
Yeah, it was a funny story. So I started as a given a little help on brand strategy when Hashdex started. Hashdex, just for everyone listening, is the largest crypto asset manager in Latin America, and now has a global footprint in Europe and the US as well. And then at that time I had joined, I thought it was going to be a fun pandemic consulting project, but you know, fell in love with the rest of the team and I already knew the business and the founders and a Bitcoiner OG. We raised a significant Series A round and I was interviewing some very fancy PR firms and a friend from college connected me with Jack, more at that time to kind of just be another person who could make introductions. And Jack's questions and his kind of what he was getting at in our first conversation were so much more thoughtful and so much less self-serving than the questions that I'd been kind of receiving from different firms that were just like, oh, is this going to be easy? Is it going to be hard? You know, those were the questions they were trying to answer. But he really asked about business model and kind of competitors. And, you know, really, I could see the wheels turning in his mind about how many different angles could we think about stories for this company? You know, what would be a longer term narrative? Who are the executives that could be spokespeople? What individual niches could they also speak to that in the totality is more than some of its parts? And so that's how we ultimately I convinced him to join. And
nice,
here we are.
Yeah. And the reason why I wanted us to share that story is because I'm not a crypto expert, but I built enough playbooks with other startups to know that, you know, Hashdex at the time, a Series A fintech from LatinAm, there's something special there. So I certainly did not pretend that I knew everything about asset management, but I knew enough to be able to identify that Hashdex was a great opportunity to build a brand. Yeah. And just to wrap up that, you know, Andrew and I really were instrumental in helping Hashdex expand to Europe and here in the US. So very proud of that.
Love it.
Yeah.
I love it. Great story. So I've now hired you guys and or some agency, and I'm assessing. You know what? How do I assess and track progress? And how do I know you're doing a good job?
Yeah, this is tough because the world of agencies and consultancies is kind of this big like gray, you know, amoeba of a term. I think in some ways we're a hybrid between a consultancy and an agency because we do engagements where there's not creative work that's being delivered.
Which is somewhat subjective. It's like, oh, I like that. You know, like right. It does express our values and our mission and our brand. And I feel good when I look at it. And that's subjective.
That's okay. I mean, there's the other end of the spectrum where you're redesigning packaging for, you know, fast moving consumer goods. And you have two options and then you're spending whatever it takes, focus groups, you know, all this other stuff, just to increase your probability of getting one right. But in startups, you need a lot more intuition. And so people with experience in that is great.
Yeah.
But it's also a reflection of the founders and the team. And you know, you don't need to overcomplicate things. But in terms of kind of figuring out success, like very early on, I think you'll just know that like if it feels right, you like working with the folks, if it feels like the work is coming together in a way that really resonates with you and the rest of the team. Because I think, you know, in addition to kind of any recommendations or creative work, alignment is kind of another like hidden deliverable that, you know, doesn't ever show up, but I think that's important too. And then as you progress and mature as a company, like tying, you know, really like defining KPIs, that, you know, they will evolve. So, you know, around say PR communications, it may be, you know, around getting the word out around key milestones, just as important of that is in the quiet periods between milestones, figuring out ways to create news. It could be whether or not you're like creating interesting content and sharing that, and that becomes a piece of news, or, you know, features, or, you know, highlighting customer success stories or whatever. And then, you know, on the brand side, I think it's really a lot more like qualitative feedback early on. And especially from customers, I think, you know, obviously I would recommend every startup founder or every leader at any size company needs to spend time with customers on a regular basis. Right. You know, it's a cliche, but
that's surprising. Get out of the building. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. The way I visually kind of picture a PR agency or, you know, a communications expert is they're the Alfred to Batman. You know, they're really the advisor and often are involved with the legal department if there's a legal case happening, patents, et cetera, or finance, you know, if you need to, you know, share your quarterly report or end of the year report. And how do you craft that storytelling so it really pumps up the investors? And then sometimes working with product and helping to develop the product messaging and supporting product marketing. So when I was in-house, I really made sure that communication had a center role and had everything. Part of it was selfish reason. It was control. Control and having visibility on where the power dynamic is going, you know, and also flow of information.
That was kind of, I gave you an answer for kind of the higher level, like brand strategy stuff or, you know, visual identity. Now, as the marketing progresses, you get into the science-y part of marketing, which is kind of your growth or digital marketing where, you know, everything is measurable, especially if it's like a software-based business.
Right.
And, you know, there you can A/B test, you know, product messages and all of that stuff. But in terms of like the strategy at the high level, which is like values and things like that, you know, that is a little bit more intuitive.
Do you guys ever do that in PR or branding? Like do A/B tests? Like, okay, here's one version of the article. Here's another version. Let's see with a smaller sample, like how it's performing. And then, you know, release broadly the better one.
So with startups, we'll do that with more of kind of like tactical marketing. Yeah. Just because usually with PR, I mean, Jack, you'll get feedback and solicit feedback for sure. But there's usually not that time to kind of A/B test. You wouldn't want to do it with like embargoed news or anything like that.
Yeah, usually, you know, with media relations, the messaging is consistent across, but what you highlight, what you emphasize more depends on the audience you're trying to target. So, for example, if it's a fundraising news, you know, we really try to emphasize kind of the roadmap of the company, the potential, et cetera, and possibly less about the product. But if it's a product launch, obviously it's a lot focusing on the product features, what's coming up next, and setting its expectations for customers.
I mean, all of this, it ultimately like should show up in the numbers in terms of driving down customer acquisition costs, driving up customer loyalty and customer engagement, also employee engagement, reducing churn rates, you know, things like that. Like one thing that it's actually like Steve Jobs used this analogy called the brand bank. And I love sharing it with startup founders because it impresses that the brand is not just a design, it's the whole experience. So any positive experience a customer has with a company is a deposit. Anything negative is a withdrawal. So you'll always eventually, if you're a long-term customer, have some sort of disappointing experience. But if there are enough deposits in there, that withdrawal on a relative basis isn't such a big deal.
Yeah, I love that analogy. I've never heard that before, but totally makes sense. So let's switch to kind of the future and kind of the trends in the present, and obviously AI, right? We got to talk about that. How is AI impacting this whole world? I mean, my podcast logo I made with Midjourney, right? Like if you go look at the Ignite podcast, I did hire somebody to do the initial Team Ignite stuff, but yeah, walk us through like how AI is impacting how you guys are doing your work. Yeah.
Yeah, no, we think it's super exciting. It's kind of a low cost disruption at this point, if you're familiar with that, like that theory. But there is an enormous amount of kind of executional like work that
you're talking about, like innovator's dilemma, right? It's kind of like,
exactly.
It's generally okay, not really good for the top notch stuff, but
that's would be
slowly over time, it will like probably replace most all of the creative work, at least the,
like what you're talking about with logos, you know, there are, I've used like a logo generator. A friend of mine is a personal trainer. I made his website. That was just a quick way to do it. But at the very high end, I think, you know, brands want something that is uniquely them. And that's not going to come as much from AI, whether or not that is the typography or the, you know, the actual, you know, design of a like visual identity. But there's like this whole kind of swath of like executional marketing that's like lower, you know, people used to just be farming it out kind of offshore, you know, for blog posts or whatever. And a lot of that is now, you know, you can really hit a lot of that with kind of generative AI. But at the high end, it doesn't really impact us quite as much because that's not the work that we do. Any content that we do is, you know, we're working with researchers and writers and designers, stuff like that.
Right.
But I think it's really exciting because in some ways it democratizes a lot of the basics of marketing. And, you know, we've even played around with kind of how do we, for, you know, startups that maybe are even too early to work with us, how can we help them? You know, and maybe that's kind of like a...
Here are some prompts you can use in ChatGPT to do good, you know, just get you down the road.
Yeah.
Like good enough for now.
And I, you know, because
you just raised a friends and family round of 250K. You have no money to spend.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we're just scratching the surface of, you know, what even like chat interfaces will be. You know, I think the Sora, like OpenAI's video model with 60-second videos, you know, those are impressive just in that first iteration. And again, that's the...
Oh, yeah. That's insane. Those videos. What other trends are you guys kind of tracking and watching, and what are you excited about for the future?
A big one over the past 3 years is kind of, I alluded to it earlier, this big regime shift where, you know, and we all saw it, especially like living in the Bay Area, so much money going into startups with a lot less discipline around how to acquire customers or grow profitably rather than just grow, just to get the right chart or growth chart. And so with that regime change and with people really rethinking how they're spending money, I think there's what we've seen among clients and people who are, you know, are scheduled to start working with is a lot more patience in terms of, and understanding and in terms of building those like relationships with customers and a community over time, which it's not, you don't, you know, dump a bunch of money in there and then all of a sudden it doubles your business. But those relationships or that newsletter that you build or whatever, that like content franchise that you develop, becomes the top of your marketing funnel or a good portion of it, and helps you acquire customers at a much lower cost. But you're also along the way, you're creating value for them before you're looking to capture value. And I think that is very important because there are, you know, many brands that kind of try and capture value right away. And I think that is, it gets the relationship with the brand started off on the right foot. So that's a big trend that we're seeing. And then obviously like many creative ways to do that, you know, not just like written content, like, you know, community or whatever.
Yeah.
And then
like a team maybe that ignites startups.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Something like that.
I'm trying to think about other ones. I mean, you know, all stuff around AI for sure has a lot of changes. And, you know, I think content, it's kind of this easy answer where people like, you know, create more and more volume of content because the best stuff tends to float to the top, get shared, and people just forget about the worst stuff.
Right.
But I think
that's why I just publish all my podcasts.
But I think over time,
you never know. Like sometimes like I'll have a clip go viral, get 100,000 views. I'm like, how did that happen?
Exactly.
You
know? Exactly.
I wouldn't have predicted that.
And yeah, exactly. And over time, I think there'll just be more curation, and that'll be part of brand strategy and brand identity, making those choices.
Jack, any final thoughts there?
Oh, yeah. I think I have three. One is I do think Silicon Valley is kind of meeting, is facing a kind of a reckoning. I mean, look at Kara Swisher's book. She just came out with Burn Book. Oh, it's a delicious read. And I think it's really calling out the bad behavior in Silicon Valley and those that are, you know, what historically have fallen victims are now speaking up. So that's a great trend. I'm advocating for it for those that face workplace injustice to speak up. So that's one. I think the second part is, this is still a very exciting time. We don't know the extent of how AI is going to change the way we live, play, and work. This almost feels like the inception of cell phone, when it was just, not even a touchpad. So the excitement's there, but I do think humans will always be in the loop to do course corrections or be involved in training the language model. So I think that's something that's exciting. We really don't know where it's going to go. So that's
cool. I think there's this very kind of on the horizon, there's this very interesting convergence of AR, VR, crypto, AI, and then new forms of, brain computer interfaces.
Right.
And that opens up just a world of kind of for, not just marketers, but experience and product designers as well. And, crypto seems poised to be moving past the speculative kind of decade that it had. We'll see. We'll see.
It reminds me of a phrase, marketing ruins every medium. It kind of saturates everything, right? Saturates display ads and search ads and email. And yeah.
So when I think about marketing, content. There's a misconception that marketing is advertising. And through that lens, I very much agree.
Mm.
If you think about marketing as really understanding the customer, their needs and their wants and how they're prioritizing them, and working your way backwards to design and develop and deliver products and services that meet their needs and create value, then, marketing is almost like half of the role of the business. There's innovation and marketing, which makes a lot of sense.
But you build things and you sell things is what I like to say.
Yeah.
And you build things and you sell things.
Just to your earlier question, it reminds me of this. I had one professor at business school and he had this very unfashionable advice because, this is a little over 10 years ago. So it's been a minute, but that was, people were very focused on growth and for good reason. I mean, Facebook and other companies, they, IPO'd before they were profitable. And his advice was always, be patient for growth and impatient for profit. And I see kind of more and more founders and leaders and investors like ourselves, looking at companies through those lenses, as well as how they're allocating capital and other activities.
Nice. So for anyone listening that's interested in getting in touch, how do they get in touch with you guys?
My name is Andrew Pushel. I'm at andrew@colony5.co. So not .com, .co. Jack is...
The numeral five. Number five, yeah.
Yep. And we have our current website is something I put together before our first client meeting, but we have a new one going up next week. So we'll have a look and feel that's more appropriate to kind of...
Well, we're about a week in a backlog to publish these. So yeah, it'll probably come out next week. So
And then we're always happy to, just have a conversation and, we really love what we're doing and we just love kind of working with founders and especially people who are really on kind of ambitious missions. So
yeah, feel free to DM me on LinkedIn. Please. Yeah. Love to help founders because I think we've been in your shoes before. So.
Love it. Well, Jack and Andrew, thank you so much for coming on. I'm sure founders and VCs out there get a ton of value from listening. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. Thank you, Brian. Appreciate it.